Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today's date is February 15th, 2007. Scheduled meeting time for 3 o'clock p.m. in Hearing Room B. Senator Brad Avakian is chair.
Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources is open. We're going to start today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 232. Mr. Graney, if you'd like to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 232 allows state agencies to construct and operate facilities for the generation of electricity and conditions the sale of the electricity generated. Provides that revenue from the sale of electricity are continuously appropriated to the agency that sells the electricity. There's a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. And for your information, Michael Mason of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs called in support of this measure.
There you go. You're not all by yourself today, then, are you?
Go ahead, Mr. Graney. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Mike Graney, Department of Energy, and we support Senate Bill 232. As Sue mentioned, this does make it clear that state agencies have the ability to develop renewable energy on state property. It's more of a clarifying bill than anything else. There were a couple of provisions. This is a bill that was introduced last session and passed the Senate unanimously and passed the House Substantive Committee, and then it got tied up towards the end of the session with a number of other bills. But it clarifies that state agencies can only develop power if there's to use on site or if there's excess power to sell on the wholesale market to utilities, both either investor owned or publicly owned and consumer owned utilities. And we interpret the term publicly owned to include consumer-owned utilities like electric cooperatives. So it doesn't put the state into retail competition with utilities. Also, in response to clarification last session, explicit budget approval for each project is required, and as a matter of fact, any project that would have cost more than $500,000 would require specific ways and means approval anyway in the capital construction account. And any renewable energy project is likely to exceed that amount. But even if it doesn't, this bill requires explicit budget approval for that specific project. Finally, the bill also requires any applicable state or local land use and other permitting approvals. It doesn't exempt state agencies from those processes for these facilities, and that was a concern that was raised in the course of the bill being heard last session. So we've included those provisions. There is interest by a number of agencies, the Military Department, for example, Department of Higher Education, PSU, Oregon State, and U of O, for applications of solar on a number of their buildings, and the Departments of Parks and Forestry as well. So we've quite a bit of interest in state agencies, and it would help be one tool towards achieving the governor's goal that 100% of state agency load be met by renewable energy by the year 2010. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Would this bill allow the department to participate with the OIT project on the ground issue that they're working on there?
Yes, sir. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, OIT is very interested in a large geothermal energy project, and this would allow that to go forward, make it clear they've got the legal ability to do so, and we could provide potentially financial assistance through our energy loan program.
Are you already working with them?
Yes, we are.
On the face of it, the bill would give the impression that the state might be entering the market as a competitor and selling energy. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the truth or falsity to that assumption.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, first, I think for the most part, the scale of projects we're looking at would be primarily for on-site use. There may be some excess power in a few limited cases. For example, some wind projects that the military department may be looking at, but even those would be small. They'd be in the neighborhood of a megawatt or so. And any excess power would have to be sold on the wholesale market, which means it would be a source of energy for the utilities. And we have been approached by both public and private utilities that are interested in working with the state on developing such projects. What the Attorney General's office tells us is that state agencies have to have explicit authority to undertake things. So except for a limited demonstration basis, state agencies cannot develop renewable energy right now. At least it's not clear that they can. That's the purpose of the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Graney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else interested in testifying on Senate Bill 232?
I know I should be brief. For the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. I do want to put on the record, though, I think it's important. We do support this bill, but it's with a clear understanding, as Director Graney said, that this would be not for retail sales. We have, for example, the little municipal utility of Monmouth, 50% of their load is Western Oregon University, and if the state were to try to in effect take away that customer, that could be disastrous. This bill does not do that. It sets up the opportunity for partnerships instead. That's something we're very interested in. But that language about making sure that it does not sell to retail customers is very important to us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 232. I'm going to open a public hearing, actually, on the next three bills that we have. Senator Schrader, if you want to come on up. Senate Bill 450, 335, and 336, not because they are all necessarily tied to each other, but just because Senator Schrader is the sponsor of each. But when the senator is done, I think what we will do is take testimony on 450, and then after that, 335 and 336. And, Senator, if you don't mind, we'll give Ms. Marshall a second to introduce the measure for us, please.
Three or just four?
Why don't you just do 450 right now?
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 450 allows certain landowners to create Rangeland Fire Protection Association. It allows the state forester to enter into cooperative agreements or contracts with rangeland protection associations to protect rangeland from fire, allows the state forester to assist rangeland protection associations with training, acquisition of firefighting equipment, and provision of liability insurance. It directs the state forester or rangeland protection association to provide fire protection after the State Board of Forestry determines that they are protected under their liability exemption. It appropriates money from the general fund to the State Forestry Department and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify a little bit on Senate Bill 450. Very simply, I think it's a pretty good bill. It's got pretty good bipartisan support, as you can see from the sponsorship. It's an outgrowth of several things that occurred over the years, recognition that fighting fires in Oregon has become a way of life, unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be. We've been trying to figure out more cost-efficient, more effective ways to protect home property and state and local budget dollars. We, over the years, have been trying to encourage some of the relatively unincorporated private acreage out there to get their act together and fight fires, and we've used the heavy hammer of suggesting we're going to force you into this district or that district and pay for it. And this is a different approach. This is an approach that's grown out of some work groups that Representative Morgan put together last couple of biennia on how to more effectively fight fires. As you recollect, we passed a bill last session that switched our approach to doing some initial attack and severity funding to get after these things early before they start burning. And that's all well and good on the lands that have existing fire capabilities, but this is areas that do not. And they're generally wide open spaces, not a lot of trees, probably not cost effective for them to form the fire districts. And so we've gone this association route. One of the principal problems with some of the association formation is a liability issue. And as these men and women on their ranches and their farms use their own equipment to help our people fight fires before they get out of control, how can we help them help themselves? And this bill basically sets up a modest investment, a general fund, to help them deal with their liability issues and encourage them to form these associations voluntarily. And so it's a little more of a novel way of approaching a partnership with some of these people on helping us fight the fires. So that's basically what we're talking about. I think it's a reasonable approach, and hopefully you'll hear a testimony in favor of it. You can see up there the amount of lands that we're talking about, some substantial acreages. Not a lot of people live there. So how can we cost-effectively encourage them to help us get after these fires before they blow out of control?
You want to go ahead and do 335 and 36 while you're here, too?
These are also very simple bills, Mr. Chair. 335, different area altogether. We're talking about changing the planning period, if you will, for the buildable land supply. Those of you that are aware, we have a buildable lands requirement in our statutes, trying to plan for the future. How much residential land do we need to have in our urban growth boundaries? And over what planning period should that buildable land supply be determined? There was a quirky change in the law in 1995 for inexplicable reasons to change the horizon, the time horizon that we would be dealing with our buildable land supply to basically the last 5 years. What has happened, and my biggest concern, I'm open to suggestions on this, is the time horizon the most recent five-year period, or should it be over a 20-year more historical trend line? In my corner of the world, which is the southern portion of Clackamas County, we've seen some exponential growth in the last 10 years. In your district, Mr. Chair, you've seen exponential growth in the last 20 years almost. Concerned that if we limit the planning time horizon for buildable home capacity to the most recent five-year trends, that it becomes basically a spiral upwards of increasing the urban growth boundary and accommodating, unfortunately, greater and greater chunks of farmland. And so is there a more efficient way to look at, more fair way to look at the time horizon under which different communities should be developing their buildable land supply? So 5 years seems a little inaccurate. It's a too short a time horizon due to long-term planning, in my opinion, that we need to be doing. I've introduced this bill in the past. It has had trouble getting a hearing when I was a House member. The powers that be at that time were not predisposed. The farm industry is somewhat concerned about this and get her testimony. This is an attempt, again, to make us more efficient. If there's a better idea that comes up to amend my bill, I'm all over it. It does not be my way, highway. I'm interested in people's opinions. This particular iteration is one that's evolved over the last 10 years of me trying to introduce this bill in one form or another and see if there's some common ground, some middle ground we can get to that allows some flexibility. Some communities may want to go less, and that's fine if that's their need and their desire. My goal is to make sure that there's at least a fairness issue here that's addressed, and we don't eat up our farm and forest land exponentially. Would you care for me to go to 336, sir?
Yeah, go right ahead. We'll save any questions if there are till you're done with that one.
Thank you. This is the simplest and easiest of all bills. It's very straightforward. Changes just one little tiny subsection of a section of the state statute and allow schools to be put on the same footing as other public infrastructure when communities are planning growth and development. Right now, because of, again, I think an oversight in a bill passed in 1995, schools were unfairly treated. There's a long history behind this. I could go into it. I will go into it a little bit, despite the fact this is a pretty simple bill, and it's the fact that our schools are becoming overcrowded. And the school districts, particularly the Beaverton School District, has tried again and again to be as fair as they could in dealing with this. They somehow were inadvertently excluded from systems development charge legislation back in 1989. They tried to deal with things on a capital basis, developing capital plans, trying to show that they're trying to efficiently deliver services for our students. We ended up having other legislation passed that that obviated that as a way to help them get out of, from underneath their particular dilemmas. And at the final analysis, House Bill 2501 was passed back in 1995 that prevented schools from being a sole criteria, you know, for limiting some of these huge subdivisions and residential development in some of our fastest growing areas. As you all know, for a development to be approved by any local planning commission or city council, the public facilities have to be in place, the infrastructure has to be in place to handle it. If there's not enough, the roads are overcrowded, it doesn't happen. The sewer plant's overcrowded, it doesn't happen. The water supply system is broken, it doesn't happen. But if your schools are overcrowded, tough beans, it happens. And that's inappropriate. Contention, it's been contended by some that schools aren't really critical essential services like sewer, water, transportation. I'd sure like the person to come up to this dais and try and make that case, because I think most of the citizens of the state consider schools a critical piece of infrastructure. This bill doesn't suggest there should be a moratorium because the schools overcrowded. I think you'll notice in portion of the same statute that moratorium, you know, regulations still hold. We're not trying to undo that. We're just trying to make schools have an equal footing with other critical public infrastructure in the development planning process. Hopefully you'll hear some testimony about why this is probably good public policy.
Question? Committee, anything? Senator Bates.
Two questions, Senator Schrader. First question on 336. As a former school board member and aware of what the growth is like in some districts, one of the problems we have is that sometimes you want to site a school just outside the urban growth boundary, maybe just barely outside of it, and we're blocked from doing it. No land was either available inside the urban growth boundary or at a cost that could be afforded. As a result, we've got a couple of mega junior high schools of over 1,500 kids in Medford because they couldn't find land. Would this allow them to be right on the edge of the urban growth boundary if the county permitted it? Would that give them an opportunity to go out in that area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'm not sure that would deal with that particular issue, to be frank with you. This is just getting to the point where schools actually begin to become part of that dialogue. It could lead to that sort of discussion in the future. But right now it's just for, I think it would be under the existing regulations where schools have to be built, I think, within the UGB or, I think it's 3-4 miles out.
Okay. All right. Second follow-up question or second question? Senator, you're noted for being sort of a contrarian sometime on the floor of the Senate. Could we count if these two bills made the floor unchanged, you'd be a yes vote on these two?
I might actually vote yes on these bills if they made it to the Senate floor. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We'll do a roll call right now, Matt, if you want to. anything else, Dr. Bates? Senator Bates, nothing.
No.
Committee?
No.
All right. Senator Schrader, thank you very much for your testimony and for bringing the bills to the committee. We are going to proceed with Senate Bill 450 before we go to the other two. So Charlie Stone and Gordon Foster.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charlie Stone. I'm a policy analyst with the Protection from Fire program with the Department of Forestry. With me today is Gordon Foster. Gordon's our range rider, as we call him. His position is primarily designed to work with rangeland protection associations and help them to form and encourage their existence, train them, et cetera. So we'll call on Gordon here in just a moment. Senator Schrader has given you a good background on the history and the reason for this bill and the rangelands. I don't have a whole lot to add to that at this point, except that I'd like to point out to you the two letters of support within the written testimony package that's being handed out to you from two of the existing rangeland associations. And then to mention, while we're the Department of Forestry is in support of this bill and would be happy to see a work session soon on it and move along, there is another issue that we're working on alongside with this, and it has to do with the possibility of extending the insurance pool that special districts are allowed to operate in, like rural fire protection districts. And if we're working with our legal counsel to determine whether they're already eligible or what would it take for them to be eligible if that was a practical piece to add to the viability of these organizations. Right now, that's moving slowly. We're not anticipating anything that would change this bill, but if it was a small piece that could be slipped in here that would help make that work, we may be looking to try and amend that and could do that over on the House side if the committee wasn't adverse to that. But so just wanted to give you a heads up, be the first one to say that things might change, but right now we don't have any changes proposed for it. And if we could, I'd like to call on Gordon to talk a little bit about the success and the progress that we're making with the Rangeland Association.
Certainly. Mr. Foster, just go ahead and state your name and launch right in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gordon Foster. I am the Rangeland Fire Protection Coordinator with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And if you look at your attachment one, what we have is there's a listing of the existing rangeland protection associations, and those are being displayed in the darker colors over here. There are eight of them. The whole concept goes back into the early 1960s when legislation was introduced to come up with this concept. So the first one was the Ironside Association, and then that was established in 1963. Later, 1998, the Crane Association and the Fields-Andrews Associations were formed in eastern Harney County. And then in 2000, a Burnt River Association was formed up in southern Baker County. In 2001, we had the Silver Creek Association over by Riley in Harney County. And then up in Wheeler County, the Twickenham Association. Last summer, two associations formed in the Brothers Hampton on Highway 20 between Burns and Bend, and then the Post Polino Associations. These are the current associations that we have. In the new areas that we're looking at, currently in the Juntura area in Harney County, or in Malheur County, which is that area there, and then we're meeting next in 2 weeks with the people down in Jordan Valley. And then we're also working in the Plusha Dell, which is east of Lakeview. We're working in the Ashwood area, which is up in northern Jefferson County. And then the Summer Lake area, which is down in Lake County. There's lots of interest been shown in this. This program has proved successful. And what I mean by successful, these people are getting equipment, forming, they're fighting fire. Last summer, there were some of the Fields-Andrews Association had about 100,000 acres on fire that they assisted with BLM. And then the Burnt River Association and the Ironsides Association. And one of the successes I like to talk about is that Silver Creek Association that was in Harney County. They had eight fires in summer 2005. And of those eight, the BLM couldn't get there. And BLM called up and says, can you go get these? They went and stopped seven of those fires at less than a half acre. And the eighth one they stopped at about 5 acres and held it till BLM could get there and reinforce them. And the concept is really neighbors helping neighbors. And we haven't had to market this program. Everybody's come to us and ask us, you know, what is this program? How can we do this? So it's been a good project. And that Harney County group, the Silver Creek group, if people are familiar with the fire that threatened Burns, I think back in 1991, well, this is the same area that we're dealing with. It's the area adjoining the forest protection districts, and these people are stopping fires when they're small, and they're providing great benefit to the overall fire protection program in Oregon.
Very good. Committee? Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I have a lot of friends, and I'm very familiar with some of the areas that you just rattled off, namely Summer Lake, Plush, and Jordan Valley, Andrews,
yes,
metro area, and the greater suburbs.
Favorite country.
Could you tell the committee how many people we're talking about that have come together, how many people make up these associations? I think that might be interesting for the committee to know.
Chairman, Senator Atkins, it's a very small number, really. It's probably, if you take the Fields Andrews Association, you're probably talking less than 30 properties. And, you know, in here, I think I have the numbers. You know, they're protecting about 156,000 acres of private land. There's some large ranches in there. It's not a lot of people. It doesn't. It isn't conducive to a rural fire district. The ranches are too far apart. But it provides ability for them to provide protection for themselves.
I think that's important to say. Thank you.
Yeah. Good question. Thank you. All right, thank you both for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. Mike Deichsel and Katie Fast.
Senator, for the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I can't capitalize and improve on the testimony you've seen. The map kind of stands for itself. As a member of the 2004 Department of Forestry Fire Program Review and also a member of the subcommittee that was dealing with unprotected lands, what you've heard today is actually the outcome and the recommendations of that committee. What we tried to do was to initiate that neighbor helping neighbor concept, and with the direction of Mr. Foster, it's caught fire, pun intended, and has spread and is really doing an excellent job. And to save any of the other details, I just see this as another example of Oregon's complete and coordinated system that has evolved over time with based on needs, and it's all based on the cooperation and partnership of the stakeholders, which is ODF, landowners of all sizes, and shame, it's not just forest land, the legislature and cooperating fire agencies. So on behalf of OFIC and our members, we're in support of the bill.
Thank you.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We're in support of Senate Bill 450. See this as an opportunity to increase fire protection throughout the state through assisting voluntary measures. This technical assistance through Department of Forestry, helping these folks organize is important, along with the liability insurance. And this is very positive legislation that we've seen handling this issue compared to past sessions. I mean, this is a result of the department and other stakeholders listening to the folks that live out in the countryside, manage these rangeland type areas, and creating a program that's working for them and helping them bring together and organize and provide fire protection for themselves.
Senator Pyor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, before you were with Farm Bureau, and Mike, I think before you were with OFIC, but it was 97th session, and prior to that, we worked on a proposal talking about these same lands, but in a different way. And as you guys probably both know, the room was filled with angry ranchers and farmers at that time when it came forward. So, Katie, I guess make sure your members have been aware of this in these areas, and they're not here because they support the bill, not because they don't care.
I will say I am very aware of the stories of 97, and our folks now who have come to those hearings in the past in opposition are working to form rangeland associations, and the Ashwood area is an example of that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you both very much for your testimony. Jim Welsh. And is there anybody else who has come in who would like to testify on Senate Bill 450? If not, Mr. Welsh, you are batting cleanup here. Go ahead.
Chair Avakian, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh. And I was a participating member of the Unprotected Lands Committee, traveled all over the states in an effort to get the message out, working with certainly a lot of the other... we had fire protection agencies, ODFNW, and others that were Division of State Lands, everybody participating in the discussions. And we try to hold those in all areas throughout the state, especially on the east side. And we do remember Senator Beyer, Chair Vakin, in the 1997 session. I remember Senator Kintai came in as a Senate Bill 360. When he came back, his eyes were still the size of saucers, and he says, "Those folks over on the east side are about ready to hang us." So, you know, he was pretty excited about what they had to say over there, when it was really kind of an effort to educate, but it was also in a different way. It was a government, we're here to help you type of approach, and they weren't taken very well. So since then, this effort has gotten out and reached a lot of the members. I'm not speaking on behalf of the cattlemen today on this one, but I understand there's quite a few of our members that are working in this program. Oregon State Grange, who I also lobby for, certainly has a thumbs up on this approach, because this is exactly how we recommended an approach be, neighbor to neighbor, and the government there to assist with the things that are included in this bill, and not to mandate something, but to bring them together so that we can eventually cover every acre in this state with some sort of a protection, especially in those unprotected areas, and protecting their land, their investments, and certainly protecting your neighbors also. So I, as a former committee member, give thumbs up here. As a participating member of the Unprotected Lands Committee, traveled all over the states in an effort to get the message out, working with certainly a lot of the other, where we had fire protection agencies, ODFW and others that were Division of State Lands, everybody participating in the discussions. And we tried to hold those in all areas throughout the state, especially on the east side. And we do remember Senator Beyer, Chair Vakin, the 1997 session. I remember Senator Kintai came in, it was a Senate Bill 360. When he came back, his eyes were still the size of saucers, and he says, "Those folks over on the east side are about ready to hang us." So, you know, he was pretty excited about what they had to say over there, when it was really kind of an effort to educate, but it was also in a different way. It was a government, we're here to help you type of approach, and they weren't taken very well. So since then, this effort has gotten out and reached a lot of the members. I'm not speaking on behalf of the cattlemen today on this one, but I understand there's quite a few of our members that are working in this program. Oregon State Grange, who I also lobby for, certainly has a thumbs up on this approach, because this is exactly how we recommended an approach be, neighbor to neighbor, and the government there to assist with the things that are included in this bill, and not to mandate something, but to bring them together so that we can eventually cover every acre in this state with some sort of a protection, especially in those unprotected areas, and protecting their land, their investments, and certainly protecting your neighbors also. So I, as a former committee member, give thumbs up here, and I want to get some letters in from those that I represent to in support of this. Okay. Thank you.
We'll welcome those. Committee. Nothing. Mr. Welch, thank you very much. We will move from Senate Bill 450 then, and we will take the next two, Senate Bill 336 and 335, in that order. And so while Ron Naso and Otto Schell come up for 336, Ms. Marshall, will why don't you just read both?
Okay.
There are some folks that wanted to testify on both bills. Just feel free to do that, since I've gaveled us in on both, to testify about both when you come up to the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 335 changes the planning period for buildable land supply inside the urban growth boundary and extends the period of time to collect data related to the growth rate. And for the record, Mary Kyle McCurdy of 1000 Friends of Oregon sent a letter of support and suggested that some of these issues should be included in the Big Look planning process. And also, we have a letter from the City of Salem in opposition. And if you want me to go ahead with 336, Senate Bill 336 removes the provision providing that school capacity cannot be the sole basis for approval or denial of a residential development application. And we've received a letter with some clarifying points from Mary Kyle McCurdy of 1000 Friends of Oregon and a letter of support from the Oregon League of Women Voters in support of 336.
Okay, Mr. Naso.
Chair Bakian, members of the committee. My name is Ron Naso. I'm the superintendent of schools in North Clackamas School District, just to the south of Portland. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 336 for a lot of very potent reasons that affect the North Clackamas School District. We're a district of about 17,000 students. We are in a an area of urban growth boundary opening. We are a district that is growing and growing rapidly, but also growing in a skewed way, in that that growth is taking place largely in one segment of our school district. Each year for the last 4 or 5 years, we've grown by a factor of anywhere from 1.75% to 3%, which in normal terms wouldn't think would be such an exciting prospect. The difficulty is that all of that growth, in some cases we have double or triple that growth in some segments of our school district. We are overcrowded. Tremendously so in one of our high schools, one of our middle schools, and in five of our elementary schools. Because of that, we had to go out to the voters in November, and we did go out to the voters in November to pass a bond issue, and it was a pretty startling bond issue, $229 million for the construction of schools and renovation. So one would think, well, gee, why are you here? Because the problem may be moot in the North Clackamas School District. Not so. What we learned during that campaign was a lot of very frustrating lessons. And this bill, I think, goes a long way toward fixing some of those. In the course of our work to try to figure out how we're going to handle growth in our school district, we sat down with developers, and even the most sympathetic of their attorneys said, the law doesn't allow you to do anything about trying to have rational planning for schools in these growth areas. We sat down with planning commissions, very sympathetic planning commissions, I might add, planning commissions that had children and grandchildren in the very schools that are being overwhelmed. And their response to us was, our hands are basically tied because of the language of the current laws that says school capacity is not a controlling force even for us in determining how and how quickly development can occur. While we were on the campaign trail, we ran into a host of very, very concerned citizens in the community wondering why we could not exert more influence on having some control over the pace of growth in a rapidly growing school, in a rapidly growing area. And I had to be, as did our board, had to be the bearers of the news that, as the law is currently written, our hands are somewhat tied. I would hope that this commission, this legislature, would look at this bill very seriously to give schools a more influential seat at a number of tables, not just the concept planning piece, but the development, the planning commissions, even to the point of being able to use school capacity as one of the considerations as to the ability to begin building. that becomes important to this school district, largely because this bond issue for us is catching up with the growth that is already there. We're anticipating within that growth boundary another 5,000. I repeat, another 5,000 residences. And in that process, we are struggling to understand or to provide a rational of including schools in the planning for infrastructure in our communities. With that, I thank you for your attention and am open to questions.
See no questions, but I know, especially on a school day, not easy for you to get away down here to testify, but your comments are very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Mr. Schell.
Good afternoon, Chair Vakian and members of the committee. My name is Otto Schell. I'm the Vice President for Legislation with the Oregon PTA. We have about 22,000 members across the state of Oregon. And in that capacity, in that job, I've been around the state in a lot of different places, and I keep hearing this issue in similar situations where people can't understand, parents in particular, why planning doesn't include schools or why planning doesn't give an equal priority to schools. And I'm a lawyer by training. Sometimes I can explain unusual things about the law, but this one I can't explain. And I know North Clackamas is the poster child of that rub, because I drive by, see the buildings going up, and recognize they have really limited options when it comes to slowing down any of that growth. I don't think it's an unreasonable request to ask in the context of this bill to change schools and put them on a common sense, equal footing with other things that we take into consideration when we're planning. A couple of my colleagues in education advocacy are on the sheet behind me, and they'll perhaps talk to you about the range of other options, the tools in the toolbox. I won't steal their thunder today. We just sat through House Bill 2525 and heard very similar discussion about how we can be planful, how we can use common sense to make sure that all the parts of our community are taken into consideration when we're building out and planning for the future, you know, well beyond the time that we'll be involved in these things. Thank you.
Very good. All right, thanks to the both of you. Peggy Lynch and Jim Green.
Chair Bakke and members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch from the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I didn't know you were going to receive my testimony ahead of time, so you have it. So basically, the League of Women Voters, a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government in order to build better communities statewide. We also support the 19 statewide goals. Goal 2 relates to coordination among governments, and that's what this bill relates to. I'm going to skip to, you've heard the fact that schools are an integral part of community, so I want to share some history with you. The chair knows that I lived in the Beaverton area for a number of years. In the early 1990s, the Beaverton School District experienced exploding growth, and of course it's still coming. They had Intel inside and nearby. And we needed more schools, more land to build schools, Senator Bates, but of course it was difficult to find land inside UGBs for schools. In 1992, DLCD awarded a grant so that the City of Beaverton and Washington County and the Beaverton School District could all get together with the Home Builders Association to figure out a way to put schools, particularly high-growth schools, into land use planning, because we all recognize that it's important that schools be a part of the community. As a result of that, the language in most of the bill that you have was created, and high-growth school districts were required to do school facilities planning, because we all said, school districts, you have to do your part. You have to pay attention to what's happening to your school boundaries. So they've spent perfectly good public dollars to do school facilities plans, which the succeeding session, the teeth of the measure was removed. It's now time to put the work that the school districts are doing in those high growth areas back on the table and say, it counts what you did. It counts that you plan. Senator Bates, you had a question regarding putting schools in nearby UGBs. One of the parts of this bill talks about assuring that schools are a part of planning. They're a part of UGB expansions. But they have to do that school facilities planning first. So the League supports this bill. We hope that that you can see where schools and communities belong together along with land use planning rules. And we hope for your support. Thank you.
Mr. Green?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Suffice it to say, our association supports this bill. One of the problems, however, we see with this bill is that it doesn't cover all school districts. It only covers high-growth school districts. And let me give you an example of a superintendent who called me today who couldn't be here and said, we've got problems in our school districts. And it's Pat Evanson Brady. She's the superintendent of the Hood River School District. And what they've got is a school district that only has a little over 3,900 kids in it. So they don't qualify under the bill. They only have a 1% growth rate, but that yields them 40 kids a year, and they're in need of two school buildings right now. This bill wouldn't help them, but we do need a process to not only help those high-growth school districts. You heard from Superintendent Naso, you've heard from Portland, you've heard from Redmond, Senator Atkinson, I know you've heard from Grants Pass and Medford on this issue. We need to take a look at this process, and I know Representative Hunt on the House side has put together a work group to do that. We're currently on that work group. John Chandler and I know who you're going to hear from very shortly, who believes this is a minor change in the law. I'm sure he'll be very supportive of this minor change in the law. And we're going to sit down, we're going to talk about this, because one of the things that I think you need to see in schools is, and I don't want to attack Thousand Friends of Oregon, but I think their letter's a little bit misleading. It isn't a funding problem that we're looking at here. That's part of the problem. But part of the problem also is lands available to school districts in order to get campus sites that will house them and be part of the larger planning discussion. Currently, there's some law, and I'm sure Mr. Chandler will bring you up to speed on those, where school districts are brought in, but it hasn't worked. And we need to find a process that does work. Does this bill do that? Maybe not. But I can tell you that we're going to be part of a larger process that does that, because school districts need to be in on those discussions at the beginning of land use planning when they're talking about huge residential or small residential growth coming in. They're an integral part of our community. My wife and I just bought a home several years ago, and one of the things that the real estate agent told us was, oh, you're coming into a great school district. Well, I already knew that. But that's one of the things they use to sell homes. And we need to be sure that if they're using us to sell homes, we need to be able to be there to provide education, programs and services to boys and girls. You've heard all the examples of what land costs. Senator Bates, you sat on a local school board looking at purchasing property of what it was. And there are several bills moving through the process. We'll be involved in those. John Chandler and I are going to work together on a work group that will hopefully get our hands around this issue, allow schools to be part of the planning process, not the end-all and be-all of the planning process, but something that gives us a seat at the table. And we're supportive of this bill, and we will work on legislation this session. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Lynch, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Green, I don't know what to say, because I was going to limit Mr. Chandler to about 3 minutes of testimony, but you goaded him like four different times, which means he's probably got 20 minutes stacked up now in rebuttal.
Mr. Chair, if I were you, I would still limit him to 3 minutes.
Lori Wimmer Whalen and Steve Frank.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of your committee. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen representing Oregon Education Association 46,000 community college faculty, K-12 teachers, and education support professionals. And this is my first time before this committee, so it's a pleasure. Thank you. We, too, are here in support of Senate Bill 336, and we want to thank both the committee and Senator Schrader for bringing the bill. We have testified, it feels like Groundhog Day, we've testified on this bill for as long as I've worked for OEA, which is a decade, so maybe this year's our year. We would like to point out that we are creating a list and are part of the work group that was mentioned before that Representative Hunt and others have put together related to capital construction needs, both on the high growth side and also for those small districts, rural districts, low wealth, property wealth per student districts who have different maintenance issues and crumbling infrastructure, and they too have capital construction needs that are not adequately being met by our funding strategies under current law. And to give you an idea of what those look like, we consider this to be a fundamental part of that toolbox, and we also have supported the creation of either SDCs or, more to our preference, school impact fees, which can be levied directly by school districts. You don't have to then go through local governments and through the bureaucracy of those hurdles, and can go to a much smaller community, potentially in some cases, that are a portion of a city or a county, not the entirety of it, and or that overlap several jurisdictions, and can levy then a school impact fee for that new construction in those districts. We also support a modest level of general obligation bonding against the full faith and credit of the state, because particularly in low property wealth districts, it may be the case that the lower interest rate would make it more possible for some of those rural and less wealthy school districts to bond for some capital infrastructure improvements, HVAC upgrades, whatever it might be, not just new construction for high growth areas. So that's another piece of the puzzle as far as we're concerned that could possibly be a remedy in that toolbox. We also support a quicker capitalization of the Education Stability Fund subaccount. You may remember 18% of lottery proceeds go into the Education Stability Fund for an Education Rainy Day Fund, but once that's capitalized to 5% of the general fund, anything beyond that spills over into a sub-account designated for capital construction. Right now there's zero pennies in that piggy bank, but ultimately we believe there'll be money in it by the end of next biennium at the current rate. Some have proposed using an increment of lottery just as one-time money over the expected rate that's in the forecast to capitalize that faster, and we would propose that perhaps that could be used as match money, kind of like the local option equalization grants are, to help local school districts with those capital infrastructure needs as well. So there are a variety of ideas out there that we are supportive of. We hope that ultimately this legislature will determine that it wants to put together a package so that we can deal with the varying needs of the 197 school districts in Oregon. And we do consider this to be a fair way to take a look at rational planning policy that includes impacts on schools. Thank you.
Steve Frank, and I'm nervous, so let me just tell you that first off. My first time speaking in front of representatives or senators was today at House Bill 25.
All right, Ms. Wimmer Whalen has never been here before either, so she did all right.
So thanks. I'll do the best.
We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm a substitute teacher now, and tomorrow I'll be teaching at the state and intermediate school, middle school, fifth grade. I'm not speaking for the school district. I'm also on the city council of state to now in state, and so and I'm not speaking for them. Neither bodies have, you know, no comments made for me have anything to do with those bodies. Over the years, I've been involved in land use. The issue of annexations has come up frequently in my life, and I've been involved with planning commissions and city councils, kind of on the outside. Now I'm in the inside on the council. What I heard frequently from elected officials and appointed officials over and over and over again was, if only we could utilize school capacity in making our decision concerning land use. You know, I really wouldn't have made that decision if I could have utilized the issue of school capacity over and over again. And the hard thing for me to understand with House Bill 2501, which I guess was the ancestor, would it be, of this, in saying something couldn't be the sole reason for a decision, that meant to me that it could be a reason. So I never quite understood why it was that that was said, but I took it that that's the way it was. The other thing was the high growth school district part of the bill, and the high growth one of the parts of this refers to any school district not defined as high growth. Subsection 2 of the section may adopt a plan for school facilities as set forth in the section subject to cooperation with the affected cities or counties. So it seemed to me there was a place for, you know, think of all the non-high growth school districts that can be affected. Their planning and land use issues can be affected by bringing more land in or developments, and you know, if that's not addressed specifically in this bill, then you know, are we leaving them out of the equation? And if that's the case, or we're not specifying, you know, we only say may adopt, then you know, maybe that's something that you can look at as far as this bill goes. But I mean, I'm obviously in support of this bill. I don't know if you've heard it as many times as I've heard it, that it's so critical that school capacity is part of planning and land use issues. But believe me, it's almost at every time or every hearing that I've been to when the decision is made, that comment seemed to come out by our elected or appointed officials.
Very good. Committee?
No question.
Senator Atkinson,
what do you teach?
Well, I can teach PP through 12, but I mean that's the license, the way the license works. But I like fourth and fifth grade an awful lot. Kids are just, they're tremendous. And in fact, what I heard was they were requesting me for tomorrow, and that's the second time I've heard it in a week that I was actually requested. I taught. Do you know Velsette's? Do people remember Velsette's, Oregon, little company town in the foothills of over by Falls City? So, I think it was Boise Town. But I taught many, many, many years ago, full time, first and second grade there. But there's nothing quite like the fourth and fifth graders. They're a great, big bunch of kids.
That's terrific. Well, thanks both of you for your testimony, Mr. Frank. Nicely done. I hope you come back again.
I don't know if you really want to say that.
No. And with that, John Chandler and Ralph Groner.
I need to step out for just a second.
Excellent.
Here's the clock for Mr. Chandler, in case Senator Atkinson wants to use it.
So, Mr. Chair, can we make a motion here that we end the committee meeting right now?
I think we've got a quorum.
Well, mine will be quicker. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME, although today that's really not AFSCME, it's Ralph Groner as a former county commissioner in Clackamas County for 8 years, and more as somebody who carried Senate Bill 100 on the floor of the House. I want to testify as to a little experience I faced at the local level regarding schools and school crowding and land use. It was my experience as a county commissioner from 76 through 85 that we had rapidly growing schools, and when we passed Senate Bill 100, not that I think history matters anymore, but He does to me. The fact is we left local options open in the bill intentionally, or I couldn't have supported it. I'm one who really does support local control to a great extent where possible. And in Senate Bill 100, under Goal 1, citizen input, when I was commissioner, we had to send to everybody involved when subdivisions were being planned primarily in Superintendent Naso's or in Oregon City, since we have Redland, Beaver Creek, and a lot of rural areas. I picked those two rather than where I grew up in West Lynn, primarily because they were county planning commission, and in those days we didn't have hearing officers, so this will shock you. The Board of Commissioners heard everything till midnight about four nights a week. There were no hearing officers. We were just getting into land use. But I can tell you that under Goal 1, citizen participation, we would send to the schools, as we would to everyone else that was impacted, asking for their input. And in fact, when North Clackamas School District would say, your approval of a large subdivision will adversely impact our ability to educate the kids. We, one, do not have the facilities, nor do we have the capacity to deal with that. The Board of Commissioners, unanimously, at the local level, could say no to that subdivision. It was a surprise to me. And then in Oregon City, by the way, the two fastest growing school districts, at least in the metro region, quite frankly, are three, Beaverton, North Clackamas, and where I live, people don't talk about, but I know my school district's packed because of the subdivisions up and down our throughout Oregon City and growing out. So the fact of the matter is I found out when I came here that at the local level, having the schools submit to me, if I were still a commissioner, a letter saying we simply can't handle it, and then we'd question them and bring them in, and we could deny. Somewhere along the line, that law was changed, and I'm not pointing fingers. I disagree with that law change because I've written down just a couple facts. They're simple. One, the schools now face, since I was working on Measure Senate Bill 100, they face Measure 5, 4750. North Clackamas has adversely and positively faced the double majority, as most schools have. And I don't really think, I'm not one who thinks systems development charges, by the way, are going to solve the ills of schools. I don't mind if you do it, but that's not really the answer. Land supply and economics have a lot to do with it, which was testified to by Jim Green. But ultimately, with me, it comes down to a scale of justice. Am I going to keep the cost of housing down, which I've always advocated, or am I going to provide quality education on the other side of that scale for kids? As a former commissioner, I voted with the kids each time. If I were a county commissioner in Clackamas County today, I could not do that. I find that that should be decided, in my opinion, at the state, at the local level, by the local people who are involved, not here in Salem. The decision to somehow say that you cannot use that as the... And I don't really think, I'm not one who thinks systems development charges, by the way, are going to solve the ills of schools. I don't mind if you do it, but that's not really the answer. Land supply and economics have a lot to do with it, which was testified to by Jim Green. But ultimately, with me, it comes down to a scale of justice. Am I going to keep the cost of housing down, which I've always advocated, or am I going to provide quality education on the other side of that scale for kids? As a former commissioner, I voted with the kids each time. If I were a county commissioner in Clackamas County today, I could not do that. I find that that should be decided, in my opinion, at the state, at the local level, by the local people who are involved, not here in Salem. The decision to somehow say that you cannot use that as the decisive factor in a subdivision was made in Salem by amending Senate Bill 100. I vehemently have always disagreed with that and still do. I respect my colleagues who may respectfully disagree with that position, but my position is that is one of the reasons our schools in our county are facing significant growth problems that I, if there's someone here who doesn't realize it, I would ask you visit North Clackamas and visit the Oregon City school districts with the mobile homes right behind brand new high schools where kids are now being packed into those school districts. So that's my position. It's not on behalf of my union, but me as a former one legislator working in land use and two as a former commissioner who implemented land use, in particularly Goal 1.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. I stepped out for a minute. I assumed you had gone first. Or did you not go first?
Bummer.
Mr. Chair?
He did.
Mr. Chair?
If Mr. Groner is going to be much more brief than Mr. Chandler, we might as well get our sleeping bags now.
There we go. All right. Actually, John, before you go, we do have still a long list of folks, and not because Mr. Chandler is up next, but I think if folks keep their testimony to about 3 minutes, make sure you hit your high points for us, then we'll be able to get everybody in on both bills. Mr. Chandler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler here on behalf of the Oregon Homebuilder Association and the Non-Moving Targets Association, apparently. I do always appreciate testifying to Mr. Groner because every time he steps up and admits to being responsible for Senate Bill 100, I've always admired his willingness to do that. We don't like Senate Bill 336. You've heard already from other folks that we were involved in the changes that are being unchanged by this bill. I submit to you, nothing about our opposition to this particular bill diminishes our support for schools, support for schools and planning. In fact, the language of 197 that is being amended here was our bill, along with Peggy Lynch and a bunch of other folks, back in 1993, fixed again in 95. And the problem you're facing here is not one of schools per se. It's of land use planning and what the proper role of a service provider such as a school district in our land use planning system should be. And even more importantly, it's one of local government school district coordination. Many of you have been on school boards or on local boards, planning commissions, city council, county commissions. It is an unfortunate fact that in many parts of our state, those entities cheerfully detest one another. They do not talk. They do not cooperate. They don't share facilities. They don't share plans. The effort we've been in over the years has been trying to say, would you please play nice together? Let's plug the schools in. Let's address their concerns. Let's make sure land's available. Let's make sure that the zoning for residential uses and for the jobs that support those residential uses takes place in accord with what the school district can do, where they have their plans going forward. If that's not working, if you look at this bill, take out not the part that's being deleted, but the entire bill, that section of the statutes, I don't believe, has been used. The work group that Mr. Green mentioned to you and what we've talked about with him and Mr. Naso and others is if this isn't working, let's figure out how to get it to work better. The answer is not to give school districts a veto over subdivisions at the permit counter. If we do that, that'll do, I think, one of two things, if not both of them. One, it'll transfer most of the growth management decisions where it really matters when people start paying attention. I mean, unfortunately, folks don't pay attention at the comprehensive planning level. They should. We pretend that they do, but they don't. They pay attention when the belly dumps show up in the lot next door. If you start allowing the veto at the permit counter, you transfer the responsibility for growth management implementation from the city council or the county commission to the school board. That's not the school board's job. Second thing it does, is in a fast-growing community in particular, it'll turn almost every local bond measure into a referendum on growth. That's not a spot the schools want to be in, I don't suspect. Should schools have a role? Absolutely. Does this bill give it to them in an appropriate way? No. Are we willing to help, along with your assistance, to figure out what that role should be? Absolutely right. This part of this needs to go to the big look, not that the big look committee should look at this, but in terms of an overarching view of Oregon land use, we have a fiction that the planning happens up here, and everybody gets involved and goes to the planning commission and pays attention and reads the paper and reads the articles, and then as it goes down to the actual implementation, the development approval, the building permit, that those become more and more mechanical. That isn't obviously what happens. That's not the way people think. But the role of schools needs to be up here. If you look at the language of the legislation, of the statute, it says that it can't be the sole reason for denial. It says if an application comes in that changes the fundamental plan, it changes this overarching part, the school district can say we can't handle it. It's only those subdivision applications that are coming in, implementing a plan that was done before, that we don't believe, I think, from a land use policy standpoint, should not be the basis for a veto. But we'll help in any way we can to clarify the system and make it work better, Mr. Chairman. Be glad to take any questions.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. I think I already know the answer, but if you look what's being deleted on page 2, line 36, you're deleting the ORS 197015 in addition to the section 11. And that's the section 10 talks about a building moratorium. And I just want to make sure that there's nothing in 197015 that does, in fact, grant a school district a building moratorium.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byron, no. 015 is a definitional section, and to be right honest, I'm not sure why Ledge Council did that, but then that's not the first time they've puzzled me.
We've got two other folks who want to testify in 336. If you want to go ahead and testify in 335, right now, go ahead. If you'd rather wait.
I'd have to go back to my files, so why don't you go ahead with the other folks, and I'll come back up.
Very good. Dana Heffer, Bill Atherton. Ms. Heffer, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Vakian and members of the committee. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 336 today. My name is Dana Heffer. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children and a former third grade teacher. While I was teaching in the North Clackamas School District, a place that's desperately overcrowded, like I'm sure many of the places you've seen, I saw firsthand how overcrowding impacts children. And in my school, we built the school to house 476 children. That's how many kids were meant to use the gym and the cafeteria and the stage and the things in our school. We then added 7 portable classrooms, so that increased our school capacity to 546, but we had 600 students. So we were desperately overcrowded, primarily due to large housing complexes going in the surrounding areas rapidly with no consideration for school capacity. What did this mean for my kids? My third graders, 8 years old, walked out of our classroom, down a ramp, past the bike rack, across the playground to go to the bathroom. We were fortunate enough to have windows. Many kids that learn in portable classrooms do not. We didn't have running water in our classroom. Most classrooms have sinks and better access to bathrooms. So whenever we had an art or science lesson, we carried buckets of water from the janitor's closet inside the building back to our classroom. Our music class was held on the stage, which now serves as the counselor's office. And 1 year, our school was asked to pick 25 fourth graders and 25 fifth graders to send to a neighboring school because of lack of space in our building. So this causes huge educational and emotional challenges for children that are learning in desperately overcrowded environments. Senate Bill 336 is very simple, and it's very reasonable. Currently, local planning commissions are prohibited by the state from making school capacity the sole reason they allow or deny a residential permit. Moving this line simply returns us to how it used to be, pre-1990, by allowing school capacity be the sole basis for a planning commission's residential permitting decision. Before the short-sighted and self-serving line was inserted into state law by our friends, the Oregon Home Builders Association, local planning commissions had the power and used it sensibly, not to stop growth, but to build healthy communities. Many will argue that Senate Bill 336 will wreak havoc on the land use system. They'll argue that schools should be involved earlier in the process instead of giving planning commissions back the decision-making authority they once had. But it's very important to make clear what Senate Bill 336 actually does. It actually allows planning commissions to simply do their job, which is to plan healthy, functional communities. Local schools are an essential part of a healthy, functioning community. When development increases more quickly than school capacity, communities suffer. This is not a moratorium on building. We specifically left the line in that prohibits moratoriums on building because that's not what we're interested in. We're interested in housing and school capacity keeping pace with each other. This bill does not encourage planning commissions to consider schools too late in the planning process, nor does it preclude planning commissions from considering school capacity earlier in the planning commission process. In fact, we're incredibly supportive of that. None of the bills that we're going to see in this committee or any other committee are going to be a silver bullet for solving our school facilities problem. Instead, we need a package of bills that's going to address a lot of different problems, and this is one of those bills. Finally, Senate Bill 336 simply equalizes school capacity with a number of other considerations that planning commissions can take into account. Oregon law currently allows planning commissions to make permitting decisions solely based on many other factors, including placement of utilities, prevention of overcrowding of land, provision of transportation, water supply, sewerage, drainage, and recreation. This list also includes adequate provision of education, which is contradicted by the language in Section 11 of ORS 195.110. This bill does not give schools special consideration. Other than schools, no other factors are prohibited from being the sole basis for a planning commission decision. It makes no sense for schools to be singled out. Although not every family moving into development will have children, everyone in the community obviously benefits from having quality public schools for the community's children. Not every member of a community has a car or commutes to work every day, but everyone benefits from having, you know, safe and adequate roads in that community. And we strongly encourage the members of this committee to support this very common sense, very straightforward bill. Thanks.
Mr. Atherton.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a great time to be in the legislature. You have an extraordinary opportunity to straighten out the land use planning program.
1 minute, Mr. Atherton.
My name is Bill Atherton.
There you go.
I wanted to lead off, Mr. Chair.
Oh, and I ruined it for you.
Focus on that. You have an opportunity. Whether it's Bill Atherton or whoever is sitting here, you have a great opportunity to straighten this system out that has gone astray. I'm Bill Atherton. I'm a citizen of Oregon, and 4 hours and 20 minutes ago, I was on a tractor a very substantial mountain range away. And I came over here to speak on this, and the same reason I was here in 1995 protesting House Bill 2709 and this 20-year land supply process. Why? Because we're losing the vision of what the state land use planning program is all about and what is so different and special about Oregon that other states envy us. And that is, we want to have smaller communities of a manageable size with open space around them, opportunities for recreation, and good transportation networks, and access to metropolitan areas that are functioning and vibrant, where farmers and ranchers live on the farms and ranches, and people who live in town live in town. But we're losing sight of that. And there's been a steady erosion where the state jumping in at the behest of people who basically make money speculating in bare land, not in building communities. The people that build the communities of this state live in the communities of those state of this state, and they know best how to shape their communities. And they know when we get on the subject of growth, I've never said no growth in my professional career, which goes back 35 years in this business. I've never said no growth, but I said there's a natural wisdom in a community that what they'll go to a size, get to a certain point, and they say, you know, this is the way we like it. And we don't want anybody else goofing it up. And this 20-year land supply business was set up, and one of the individuals here in this room, I'll quote him, it was to keep land in production. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't feel like I'm production. My efforts in my community, my property taxes, the money that I've put into my community in building my home and my business is not for somebody else to exploit for production. And this whole business about the costs of growth and the SDCs, that's part of what we really need to change. I can give you a four-point program. One, get rid of this 20-year land supply law. It's not state business. If a community gets to a certain size and wants to be that way, that's their choice. And if want somebody, like people in the, some people in this room perhaps want to call them NIMBYs, so what? That's, you're not going to reorder the position of the planets. That's the way people are. And if you build a nice community, yeah, it's going to be desirable. And let it go, be that way. Maybe you'll learn something from it and go to the next community and build it up to the point where people say, hey, you know, it's done. So get rid of the 20-year land supply law. Allow communities to collect for the full public subsidies of growth. We had a governor's commission on this whole subject. All of these subsidies do, failing to collect full SDCs for police, fire, libraries, schools, and the whole range, which totals up range between $35,000 and $55,000 per house in this state, that's a subsidy that props up the speculative value of bare land. That's all it does. And it's very harmful for a public purpose because it prevents cooperation in planning. And I've been doing this a long time. And the only way you're going to build livable communities, you have to plan in bigger areas and larger parcels than every little 5-10 acres along a farm-to-market road. It's bigger areas. And you're not going to get that kind of cooperation to have people plot as real estate and plan effectively if one guy is always going to be able to pull a gotcha and say, hey, I can make fast bucks at the expense of the community. Which gets to my other third point is about Measure 37. We're going to be talking about that some more. That's another great opportunity to right a wrong there. And I think you can do that very simply by just saying, look, you know, people don't want government making land use rules that devalues their property. Okay, have it take place at the date when it was enacted, not kick back 60 years as it has in the community that I'm living in, where it's raising holy hell. And in other words, another part of this four-point program is to allow citizens to have a vote on annexations. So what we're talking about here are two bills that fit into this rubric of straightening out our land use planning program. And I just, you know, I haven't had a chance to review the details of these things, but, you know, as I say, 4.5 hours ago I was out in the tractor planting field. But I'm sure we could get into the minutiae of these things, but I just want to share with you this basic four-point program that I think will set Oregon back on a direction that will save our communities. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And we'll open it up for questions. I do appreciate you making that long drive out here. It's valuable for us to be able to listen to your perspective.
Where do you come from?
Senator Bates wants to know where you came from.
The mountain range way out there.
The mountain range was in Cascades, and I'm over trying to develop a youth education facility as part of our truck farm and cattle operation.
Very good. Thank you. None. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. When you say you drove 4.5 hours and were on a tractor that long ago, you get a few extra minutes to testify. But the with the exception of you, Mr. Chandler, because we wouldn't believe it. But the if we stick with about 3 minutes per person, we will be able to end by 4:45, and everyone will have a chance. Richard Reed and Art Schlack. And we did just move to 3:35. Senate Bill 3:35.
Chair Avakian, would it be all right if I went ahead and testified on 3:36? I was first on the list there.
Sure. Go ahead and just hit both of them in succession here.
Okay. And it will be brief. Regarding Senate Bill 3:36, I do want to thank Senator Schrader and the committee for bringing the bill. I'm Richard Reed. I'm chair of Oregon Communities for Voice and Annexation. We've been assisting citizens. We're a statewide organization, and we assist citizens to obtain the right to vote on annexations. We so far in about 30 Oregon communities. And the members and board have asked me to testify today on Senate Bill 3:36. We do support it. It confirms the right of local jurisdictions to consider school capacity the sole basis for approval or denial of any residential application. We just want to note that the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators February 1998 survey determining the need for additional classroom space. This was quoted in Evan Fodor's assessment of statewide growth subsidy. At that time, the Coastal Survey identified a deficit of some 2,280 classrooms statewide, and in 1998 dollars, that was an estimated cost of about $672 million to bring those classrooms, to create those classrooms. Unfortunately, we're unaware of more current data and expect that the need for new classrooms hasn't changed significantly. There's a real classroom deficit, if you will. Senate Bill 336 recognizes that new construction creates a permanent demand for services, including education services, and it recognizes the link between new construction and the demand for classrooms. We just hope the committee will pass the bill out. Thank you. I don't know if there's any questions on that. And now to Senate Bill 335. Again, we want to thank Senator Schrader and the committee for bringing the bill. We support the bill, and it confirms the public commitment of up to a 20-year supply of buildable land. We note, however, that land supply is an extremely flexible concept influenced by macro and microeconomic conditions, changes in land use planning, changes in local codes and zones, and changes in population trends. Many are concerned about the lack of clear definition of key terms that lead to an almost inevitable increase in population with little disregard for its social, economic, and environmental impacts. For example, and this gets into, as we're reading the bill, we're looking at ORS 197. We think there could be some further amendment there. I won't go into all of this in boring detail, but just simple concepts like buildable lands, perhaps that should be changed to underutilized land so we can recognize where those places are in our community and include those in the buildable land inventory. Half-empty parking lots come to mind. We especially support the deletion of the entire Section 5EB and the insertion allowing geographic areas, time periods, and economic cycles different from paragraph A in the subsection. We believe the consideration of buildable could be conditioned by the financial ability of the local community, local government, or metropolitan service district to provide and maintain services to that buildable supply. We're just talking about refinements in the law now. Regrettably, what is buildable now is narrowly defined to housing capacity when the underlying carrying capacity is the more appropriate determinant. We suggest other elements of capacity that should be included in the consideration of housing capacity, such as community service capacity, community finance capacity, or especially, again, carrying capacity. Again, demographic could be specified to say those demographic profiles known to enhance community life. There are some planning efforts made now that distinctly seek current, certain demographics that result in, higher wages, more community involvement. Finally, referring to the amendment of the UGB to include sufficient land for new public school facilities, we think that could be broadened to include essential public service facilities because efficient public facility siting can direct growth and save public funds. Nevertheless, we hope the committee will pass the bill out. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Slack. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 335. After review of the bill, we find that the proposal has considerable merit. We believe that it would provide more flexibility in the state's planning program and also the ability of counties and cities to work together to plan orderly growth within their areas. One of the things that is would be extremely important when we look at planning urban growth is the relationship between providing infrastructure and expanding urban growth boundaries. And again, this is an area I think that this proposal would help benefit. One of the foundations that has, I believe, been overlooked as we look at expanding urban growth boundaries is the responsibility to serve land inside the boundary before the boundary is expanded. We have, and we've seen occasions where there's considerable amount of land inside a boundary that is considered not serviceable, or because the infrastructure has not been extended. And taking that into account and looking at planning up to 20 years would provide more flexibility in that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, both of you. Appreciate you being here very much. Randy Tucker and Don Schellenberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm going to speed up your time frame here and simply say that I second Mr. Atherton's speech. He essentially gave my speech in a more eloquent manner than I could. And with that, I will say that Oregon Farm Bureau supports Senate Bill 335 and encourage your passage of that. And you can read my testimony. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, I'm with Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. Can I have Mr. Schellenberg as the remainder of his time?
No.
I actually was going to talk a little bit longer, but I'll keep it. Well, we'll see how I keep it. Over the last, first of all, I'd like to say that Metro doesn't have a strong position for or against this bill. Actually, there's some portions of the bill as drafted that we would probably find congenial, other parts that we would not. I think I'm really speaking to the impulse behind Senate Bill 335 more than anything, as Senator Schrader described it when he testified today. Over the last several years, it's become increasingly apparent that, at least in the Portland metropolitan area, and this is apparent to people on various sides of the political spectrum on land use issues, that the UGB process is not working. One of the ways to describe what's wrong with the process from our perspective is that from the Metro Council's perspective, is that it hinges inordinately on two sort of crude and arbitrary numbers, 5 and 20. As you've heard from me before, you'll hear again, Metro is the only jurisdiction in the state that's required to reevaluate its urban growth boundary every 5 years, but that's in another bill that's in another committee at another time. And so for today, we're talking about the other number, the 20-year number. And as you know, statute and administrative rules currently require us to have a 20-year supply of land for residential uses and other uses in the urban growth boundary. For the last year and a half, the Metro Council has been working with citizens and local government officials from throughout the region, as well as other organizations, business groups, et cetera, on a major reevaluation of the way we plan for the long-term future of the region. And the little sheet that I've handed out today is sort of a result of that process. It obviously doesn't speak directly to the bill, but it speaks to an alternative way of addressing the needs for land and urban growth boundaries. It's an ambitious agenda that you have in front of you, and rather than walking through all of it, because it's really a long-term agenda, not all of which is going to be even attempted this session, I just want to say that it gives you a taste of why we think the 20-year supply law kind of fails to resolve the real problems we face, and how the current 5 and 20 paradigm might be transformed. One of the basic problems with the 20-year supply law, as Mr. Schlack just said a minute ago, is that bringing land into the UGB doesn't really make it available for development. The legislature commissioned a study on industrial land, actually on a bill that was brought to the legislature by Mr. Chandler about 6 years ago, possibly, House Bill 3557, which concluded that the problem for industrial land wasn't necessarily a lack of supply, it was a lack of serviced supply, land with services, and the money to provide those services. And the same can be said for residential land in the Portland metropolitan area, and the poster child sort of for that problem, I believe, is in your district, Mr. Chair. It's the Bethany area, which is the exact kind of land that the development industry asked the Metro Council to bring into the urban growth boundary 5 years ago, and 5 years later, not a house has been built because of the inordinate cost of providing the infrastructure. So there are a lot of different problems that need to be addressed, and not just providing a 20-year supply of land. That doesn't solve the problems. I could go on for a while, but I want to work with you. I won't. Don't worry.
But the bill is not moving today, and you will have another chance to come. So,
right. Yeah. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair, and want to just continue the conversation about how to. that need to be addressed, and not just providing a 20-year supply of land. That doesn't solve the problems. I could go on for a while, but I want to work with you. I won't. Don't worry.
But the bill is not moving today, and you will have another chance to come. So,
okay. Yeah. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair, and we want to just continue the conversation about how to reform the UGB process.
No, certainly. Thank you both very much. John Chandler and Linda Ludwig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. I'm not sure if it's safer to go before or after, John, but I guess I'm going. To Senate Bill 335, the League has no position on the bill, but I'd like to share a couple of thoughts with you. Two parts to the bill. There's the 20-year supply going forward, and there is the look back for which that data that you gather is based on. In terms of the going forward up to 20 years, when you do that buildable land inventory, that starts with one figure. That's the coordinated population forecast that's done by counties and allocated out to cities. We can't do that without that population forecast. Through the Goal 14 rulemaking, we discovered that more than half the counties have either never done that or those numbers are more than 10 years old. So I would share with you today that no matter what the outcome with this bill is, that is a very important piece of the puzzle that we need to work on legislatively. In terms of the look back, going back, the bill provides a different period of time, going back to trend data for 20 years. This, on page 2, lines 13 through 35, we negotiated with Mr. Chandler and company for quite a period of time. And I would say that as the language currently sits in the bill, it does provide a 5-year period, but gives us the flexibility, local governments, to look at a broader length of time. That was the outcome of those negotiations in 2001, and I believe that better serves local government as the language sits there today. Lastly, I just would like to mention, in terms of looking at the planning period, like the flexibility that the bill gives us, but on the city side of the equation, we're becoming more and more aware of the need to integrate what we do with our land use planning with what we do with our water planning, our water supply planning. And I would submit to you today that most of the plans that we do on the muni side for water supply and permit extensions run a 20-year period or a 20 to 50-year period as the industry standard. So as we move forward in adjusting some of these other plans, such as our TSP and our water supply plans, it would be nice to coordinate those time frames in an integrated process.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler again, Oregon Home Builders Association. I would be remiss if I didn't call your attention to the wonderful bit of editorializing from the Bend Bulletin, one of our finest daily papers, who had the courtesy to editorialize against both of the bills in front of you, which I thought was awfully decent of them. We're not all that wild about 335 either, surprisingly. However, I think that it raises a number of very interesting issues for this committee or for the Big Look Task Force or both. I think, with all due respect to some of the folks you've heard, the 20-year land supply doesn't drive demand. It services demand. 20 years' worth of land in Burns is not a whole lot of land. 20 years' worth of land in Beaverton is a much different number. The whole point of the planning program and the reason we use 20 years as a rubric over since the thing started was to give you a little bit of a cushion so that you didn't have price spikes in areas of the state where a lot of people were moving and a lot of jobs were happening. Whether 20 years is the right number or not, Mr. Tucker's absolutely right. We've been solving perhaps the wrong quest, the wrong issue over the years. We've had a lot of bloody battles and trips to Luba and the Court of Appeals over years 17 through 20, and we really haven't figured out how to serve years 1 through 5 with infrastructure, roads, water, etc. Maybe that's a better conversation. Maybe 20 years isn't, we should ignore 20. In fact, with as few few minor corrections here. I'd agree with Mr. Atherton said. If communities want to have local control and go from 0 to 20, let's have them go to 0 to 100. I was trying to figure out the rhetorical flourish of 0 to infinity, but that sounded like a Disney line. If that's a whole different conversation, though, than simply land supply. That takes it much more into a complete rewrite of Oregon's land use system. I don't think the bill as written accomplishes the purposes that I suspect are behind it. In fact, the section that Ms. Ludwig was talking about on the second page would probably result in much larger urban growth boundary expansions at the risk of arguing against interest, because if you take a 20-year snapshot of the community, you're going to have much lower density than you would if you took a 5- or 3-year snapshot in most parts of Oregon. Frankly, we're fine with that. We argued pretty hard to keep that language out of the bill in the first place. We're delighted to see it taken out this time. Wouldn't recommend it. Be happy to work with you if you move the bill into a work group or some other conversation, Mr. Chairman. Be glad to take questions.
No questions today. That's all right, committee. We've got 4 more people and just a few more minutes. So Bob Rendy and Don Miner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I've given you 2 pages of testimony, and I don't intend to read it or repeat it. I wanted to make a couple of points clear, and I think the previous panel made most of the points that I was going to make. First of all, the notion...
Did you say your name?
I'm sorry, Bob Rendy with the Department of Land Conservation.
Thank you.
First of all, the notion that in 1992 or 5, when ORS 197-296, that somehow established a 20-year supply is simply wrong. The 20-year supply was established by LCDC as the first land use plans came to them for acknowledgement in 1979, and it applies to all cities and all urban growth boundaries in the state, has been applied since the program began. ORS 197-296 only applies to cities over 25,000 and to metro. So I don't know that anybody's pointed out that by allowing the largest cities in the state to ostensibly go down to 0 a land supply while having all the rest of the cities accommodate the growth in the state, I don't think that's good land use policy. I don't know if that was the intent, but that would be the result. We believe that 20 years is a good number, because it's not simply a matter of supply for planning purposes, although many cities, as Ms. Ludwig pointed out, like to use that time horizon. It results in available land that helps with one of the bigger problems we have in the state, which is housing affordability. ORS 197-296 is about affordable housing, and providing sufficient land for affordable housing is something that, if we don't do that, if we don't provide 20 years of supply, in fact, if we allow communities to go down to ostensibly a 0-year land supply, we are going to have just nothing more than higher housing prices. Also, those communities that choose to do that are simply putting the burden on neighboring communities that I think probably haven't planned and aren't ready to take that burden. Right now...
I'll need you to wind it up pretty quick.
Yes. One final point I wanted to make here is that right now, as Ms. Ludwig pointed out, population drives 20-year land supply. Those forecasts are done generally by Portland State University and other based on formulas that even I don't understand. If a community today does not want to grow, and it's happened, St. Paul doesn't want to grow, Ashland wants lower growth, the county is empowered today to allocate that population to a neighboring community. In the case of Ashland, I think it was Central Point. St. Paul, I think that growth went to Woodburn. So we already have a mechanism for some communities that choose and strongly choose to grow at a different rate. They can do so in coordination with their county, provided then that growth is allocated to other communities that are prepared to take it on. And I think that system, that's in place today, and that system works. And I would argue that we don't need this bill as long as that mechanism is in place. And if we do have this bill, we want to rethink that mechanism. I'll conclude there. I have some other points that I've made in the letter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 335. I started representing our industry in 1979 in the area of land use. And I remember the discussions over the 20-year supply. The counter group was to include an amount of land called the market factor so that there'd be... the supply of land would exceed the demand and therefore moderate price fluctuations. 20 years was settled on, but that really doesn't seem so long when you consider a program that's touted as a long-range planning program. 1987 seems like yesterday to me. If I could lose some weight, I'd probably have some clothes from then I could wear. My understanding is proponents of this measure want to use this as a device to reduce the amount of land inside of the urban growth boundary. We don't believe there's enough land already. I have given you a copy of the Oregonian article. Folks interviewed in there. The article speaks to mobile home parks being closed throughout the state. We're seeing them in Washington County. We're seeing them here in Kaiser now. Not just old mobile home parks, but newer communities where folks have been there, maybe just as little as 10 years, with homes they have mortgaged for up to 30 years. It's a severe problem. If I could speak to the bill very briefly, on page 1, line 20, the planning period would be determined by the local government, but the bill doesn't contain any standards. If I could put my selfish hat on as a property owner, I would prefer probably that they choose a one-year horizon, or at least a horizon that guaranteed that my property would double every few years. I think it'll be a problem. I think the bill will further dislocate development community's ability to provide affordable housing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you both very much. Catherine Kehoe and Harlan Levy, you're the last two up today. So please come up. We'll take just a couple extra minutes to make sure that you can get your testimony in.
Am I first?
Yeah. I'm Catherine Kehoe, and I am resident of unincorporated Clackamas County in the UGB. And I'm here today to submit testimony in support of Senate Bills 335 and 336, and I believe these bills are long overdue. I'm kind of shorten my testimony and everything. And they're also a step in the right direction in response to budget crises experienced by communities across the state, a result of Oregon's current growth policies. And the legislature helped create these budget crises in many cases by preventing local jurisdictions from addressing money problems caused by unfunded state mandates and policies. The state has promoted growth and immigration through poor public policies and land use laws. Especially to blame is the state statute mandating a 20-year buildable supply of land within cities' UGBs. This mandate, in essence, forces communities to grow and taxpayers to subsidize that growth while lowering their current level of public services and quality of life. Also to blame are the limited cost recovery through SDCs when the 1989 SDC Act was passed, as well as the fact school capacity cannot be the sole reason for denying new development applications. I have firsthand knowledge of the result of the 20-year land use supply. I've been involved in the Park Place concept plan, which came about because Metro allocated areas to Oregon City's UGB. And these areas were added to the certain area due to the fact that a developer went to Metro first to figure out what the housing requirements were, then went to the city and said that he would have a development plan in this area since Metro was saying that the city had to expand its UGB so it could take areas or the UGB expansion in other areas to this new area. This was done without research prior to this revised recommendation, and a result of that, we're now running into the situation where the developer wants to develop in landslide territory. The city has been spending over about $300,000 on this concept plan, and there's no guarantee that it's going to happen. I believe the decision was rushed and unresearched, and it was a result of the 20-year land supply. I wrote to Metro sent an email to Ray Vallone, who's the principal planner of Metro, and I asked him for an explanation of the UGB expansion, and he said to me that I was correct that the EO's recommendation for the certain areas, there was no final ranking of the exact areas because they were not part of the EO's recommendation. The ultimate decision by the council took into consideration the entire body of knowledge, weighted with the willingness of the local jurisdictions to serve the areas, and limited to the identified 20-year housing need for the region that the state requires. For these reasons, the final decisions like these are always based in part on technical analysis, willingness by our regional partners, and need to satisfy the state. That is, they are ultimately a balance of data and art or politics. With this said, there really wasn't a need to reanalyze every partial study area configuration scenario that the council discussed in the last hearings before the decision, because the analysis and rankings were already completed for the entire study area. The so-called test of whether we did enough analysis came with a scrutiny by the State Land Conservation and Development Commission, which reviews our decisions and buys off on them or not. In the case of the 2002 decision, the state found we met the burden of proof for almost all the study areas brought into the UGB, including the Oregon City area ones. If you want to continue to discuss the detailed what's and why's of that decision, I suggest we talk in person about it. As for your questions to Paul Ketchum regarding slope stability analysis, he will be there to address it. I do know, however, that we do not do a geotechnical slope analysis as part of the UGB expansion decisions. First of all, it would be prohibitively expensive to do so on 80,000 acres of potential sites. Second, that level of work will be done as the local land use and permitting process before buildings are erected. I responded to him at a community forum, and I said to him that there's an inventory map and report of areas prone to landslides prepared by the Department of Geology, Portland State University, headed by Dr. Scott Burns, professor of geology at PSU, which was prepared as a fulfillment of Metro Contract 905.
Ms. Kehoe, I'll need to have some idea about how much longer you have, only because we've got another hearing about ready to start.
Anyways, I have proof that they had the inventory maps and this information prior to the UGB expansion. I also wrote to Lane Shetterly about this information, as there was an appeal. There was an appeal filed for the UGB expansion, and they still ignored it. So because of the 20-year land supply and the UGB expansion, cities are now starting to have a problem with servicing their community. Right now, I live in a semi-rural area, and I have pictures as a result of development in the surrounding area without money for infrastructure. That right there is a picture of a girl who is a high school student involved in a very terrible wreck, and I don't even know if she survived that wreck or not. And part of the reason is because these semi-rural areas are now beginning to be developed surrounding it without money for infrastructure improvements. People are driving way over the speed limit, and, you know, they're saying, well, I'm sorry, there's just no money for it. Well, that answer's not good enough for me, and I'm sure that answer's not good enough for that girl's parents. I also have a memo here from the chief of police stating that they can't service any more homes and any more development. I know I'm running out of time here, so if you want, I can email you.
You know what I would like?
Full testimony.
You know, I appreciate you very much coming today, and I am sorry that we've rushed at the end. This bill will be up for a hearing again at some point, and although it means another trip, I would encourage you to come down and talk with us again, and certainly you can email or submit some written testimony.
Okay, great.
And Mr. Levy, you have got quite literally about 60 seconds.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I just wanted to state for the record that we do oppose both Senate Bill 335 and 336, and I would welcome the opportunity to participate in any work groups that you should decide to appoint. And that's it.
Good. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearings on 335, 336, and 450, and with that, we are adjourned. Floyd, I'm sorry we went late.